This program is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U from the Distance Education Department of Reformed Theological Seminary. For more information on RTS degrees and programs, please visit us at www.rts.edu or call 1-855-854-6920.
I do want to say a few things about other forms of education. I want to spend a few minutes discussing public education, private education, higher education, and theological education. And I want to discuss all of these because, as a pastor, if you in ministerial vocation, you'll be asked about these things. And if you take any leadership role in the church, you'll be confronted by a parent in your church who needs to make an educational choice. These are issues that engage parents. These are issues that divide churches. And they do belong, broadly conceived, to the topic of Christian education. So let's begin with just a very brief survey of public education in America. Is it a sin to send your children to government schools? There are Reformed believers out there who say that. It is sinful. There are churches out there who argue it is a disciplinable offense to send your child to a government school. The first thing we might want to ask is, how did we get this term government school with all the odious connotations attached to it? Public schooling in America is a tale that really focuses on two individuals. First was Horace Mann. Horace Mann was an early advocate of common schools in New England. Education, he said, should be free, it should be universal, and it should be non-sectarian. He was raised in a devoutly Calvinistic home. He would jettison his Calvinism for Unitarianism. He was largely self-educated, but eventually graduated from Brown University, had a career in law, but eventually became the first secretary of the Massachusetts Board of Public Education. And his philosophy of education, he had five key fundamental propositions. A republic cannot be both ignorant and free. A quality education was necessary for civic virtue, and this applied for both rich and poor. The public should pay for, sustain, and oversee this education. It's best provided by public schools that embrace children of all religions, all social and ethnic backgrounds. And it should be provided by well-trained and professional teachers. Now, all this was fine because the unstated assumption was that these non-sectarian schools would be Protestant schools, because Protestantism was the established, unestablished religion, as we saw in the early years of the American Republic. And they were called common schools largely because they were under local supervision, control, and review. They concentrated on the famous three R's of education: reading, writing, arithmetic. They were non-sectarian, although again Protestant, and in some cases, there was early warfare when Jews and Catholics protested the King James Version that was read in schools, that was posted in Ten Commandments. But these, of course, were all symbols that Protestants still ruled the country. Common schools turned into public schools, at least the language turned that way, when local control expanded to regional control. You had, around the turn of the 20th century, the creation of unified school districts. You had an increasing sense of the professionalization of education. And you had child labor laws that encouraged the universal right to private education. These kids were no longer burdened with having to work the coal mines, the steel mills. They were now subjects they could now be pupils in the public schools. And the principal champion of the public school movement was John Dewey, the second important figure. Born in the lovely state of Vermont, he earned his PhD at Johns Hopkins University when that was a relatively new and thriving, a new and innovative school, premised on the emerging German system of higher education. He studied under the noted pragmatist Charles Peirce, and very active in educational reform. Among his key ideas was that the most important principle in any philosophy of education was experience. The child was to experience nature and the natural world. It was through this experience that he would come to a greater knowledge and understanding. He was an avowed atheist, a humanist, and he called his approach instrumentalism. Educational concepts were useful insofar as they were instrumental for solving problems. Now, language like that, it's hard not to imagine how John Dewey would become the poster child for all that is evil and wicked in public education. But that really wasn't the reaction to Dewey at first. For most of the early 20th century, there was an ongoing sense, if increasingly fragile, of this Protestant establishment that that ruled and ran public education. When did people start to talk about government schools? This comes later. This comes in the 60s. There is less conflict with Dewey than there is with conflict with Darwin. When Darwin enters and his theory of naturalistic evolution enters the public classroom, now we have public education sanctioning unbelieving science. If the common schools became more regional as public schools, they became governmental in the rhetoric of many Christians with the federalization of education. It was 1979 when the Department of Education became a cabinet-level post in the White House. and that was at least a symbol of increasing government control and the loss of local ownership of schools. J. Gresham Machen was, decades before this, a very prophetic voice about the dangers of the federalization of and the forced uniformity of education. Now, he wasn't arguing so much about the dangerous effects of government as the loss of localism. It was this homogenization of society that we would all teach some dreary and uninspired universal curriculum that he feared. But for a lot of evangelical activists, it was more was at stake than that. You can scarcely pick up a fundamentalist textbook on education without seeing somewhere a chart like this. It shows the rise of SAT scores among American high school school children until a certain point, and then you see the plummeting score results. And what is this date? When did this happen? This happened in 1963. And why did it happen in 1963? Well, this is it. Prayer, by Supreme Court decision, was taken out of public schools. American public school children no longer had a prayer. And look, here's all the evidence we need. Scores went up. 1963, scores went down. Well, we know that causation, that correlation doesn't mean causation. But it didn't stop crusaders from employing the post hoc ergo propter hoc logical fallacy here. But it was at least a symbol. If they were too exacting in the date, it certainly was a symbol that this was a time when public education went from religious establishment to established disbelief. And this is where you see the rhetoric gain ascendancy of government schools. You see the explosion of educational alternatives. Today, there are many choices, among them Christian schools, homeschooling, and classical schools. It's misleading to talk about a Christian school movement because there have been many Christian school movements. In fact, long before 1963, there was the rise of there were many Christian schools, private religious education, created by immigrant groups who wanted to preserve their tradition and often even their tongue. So you had Lutheran schools, you had Jewish schools, you had a lot of schools in the Christian Reformed tradition. The Christian Reformed tradition, if you're familiar with the Dutch Reformed immigration into North America, it took place in two waves. The early immigration was characterized by Reformed Christians who became part of the Reformed Church in America. And the Reformed Church in America immigrated largely in colonial times, and they were very eager to Americanize. They founded New Amsterdam before it became New York. You heard the name Peter Stuyvesant. This was the Dutch Reformed influence. This movement has largely assimilated into American culture, even as the RCA, the Reformed Church in America, has assimilated into the broad mainline Protestant world. A later wave of immigration in the mid-19th century produced the Christian Reformed Church that established Dutch-American ghettos in places like Grand Rapids, Michigan, Pella, Iowa, Holland, Michigan, and places like this. And it yielded a very robust educational institution, a set of institutions like Calvin College, Dort College, Trinity Christian College, and things like this. They were insistent on avoiding the assimilation error that previous Dutch immigration did. And one key way to avoid assimilation was to form parent-controlled Christian schools. So the Christian school movement was very strong in the Christian Reformed tradition. It's waning now. It's on the decrease because... Well, for many reasons, but at least one of them is the they have gradually succumbed to the pressures of assimilation. But it is really of more recent vintage that we see the rise of Christian schools of a more fundamentalist orientation. I remember noticing a few years ago, in 2006, there were a lot of Christian schools in the South, prestigious Christian schools in the South, some Christian prep schools in the South that were celebrating their 50th anniversary, meaning that a lot of schools were formed when? 1956. Why is that? What happened in 1956 that would prompt a lot of conservatives to form Christian schools in the South? This is Brown versus the Board of Education that desegregated public schools. The reaction was to send your children, your resources, into private education. There are a host of there. You will hear about organizations that are more or less reformed, consortia of Christian schools. There is one of them. One noteworthy one is the Association of Christian Schools International. This is a group that had strong reformed roots that was trying very self-consciously to offer day school education from a distinctively reformed perspective. It has over time become a broader and less distinctively reformed. But the simple point here is that don't mistake every Christian school for operating out of the same from the same principles, the same motivations. There are almost as many rationales for Christian schools as there are Christian schools. Let me say, I'll reverse the order here. I want to say a few things about classical schools. What do we mean by classical schools? We're talking about the movement, the more recent movement of Douglas Wilson has headed, championed this, discovering the lost tools of learning. Wilson wrote an eloquent book about the work of Dorothy Sayers, and he and others have created this movement that seeks to emphasize the trivium in the classroom, which honors Dorothy Sayers' analysis, her and others, of stages in child development, so that classical Christian schools are organized around a grammar stage. Kids are made mainly parrots. They talk. They repeat back what you told them. This is the early stage of development when, for example, memorization, rote memorization, is particularly pedagogically effective. This yields the dialectical stage, the pert stage, when children are talking back, they're challenging you. The rhetorical stage, which is high school, the poet stage is that point when the child is ready to sees writing and speaking skills flourishing, and you have pedagogical strategies like debate and things like this emphasized. These classical schools are known for being academically rigorous. The claim is that children will master the Latin at a very young age, will be well read in the classics, and be prepared for that scholarship into an Ivy League school. At least that's what some parents are hoping for. One of the things that I've observed about the classical school movement, which has much to commend it, and I think that this is a this analysis of an accommodation to these stages of childhood development are wise to embed in your pedagogical methodology, but a classical Christian school really struggles in our day and age to deliver on all its promises. And too often it's the case, in my experience, that there can be a yawning chasm between the idealism of the rhetoric of a classical Christian school and the actual practice of a school. Let me just give you a couple of examples. This idea that children will master Latin is very difficult to execute when enrollment numbers are changing every year. I'm speaking, I know about the Geneva School, my wife works there, and it's always a struggle every year to get parents to renew for the next year. A big factor is simply finances. It costs an awful lot. This school has a fine faculty that they pay reasonably well. It costs to send your kid to the Geneva School. It costs tons to send multiple kids to the Geneva School. And many parents decide after a year they've got to find a more affordable alternative. Many parents find after a year that they need something that's better tailored to their child's learning. It's just too much homework. So when your enrollment figures are constantly changing, when you're admitting new students in every third grade, every fourth grade, every fifth grade, every September or August, when you're losing the same every May, it's very hard to sustain a language program or other advanced programs. So I sense that they don't really get beyond Latin 101 in places like this. Another issue is that for all their attention that they want to give to the arts, to music, and cultivating in children an appreciation for the true and the good and the beautiful, what is it for the average parent of a teen that's the sine qua non of high school? What's that extracurricular experience you have to have? You have to play interscholastic sports. Okay? So the classical school symphony orchestra is not going to come ahead of plans for the soccer team or the basketball team. Or else little Johnny's not going to be going there, right? So you've got these economic factors, these cultural factors that make contemporary expressions of the classical model a really, really hard sell. A little bit now about homeschooling. How did homeschooling happen? Our children are largely homeschooled. And we started, let's see, it was 1990, I think it was. And I remember a friend of mine saying, you know, the only people who homeschool are hippies and fundies. And he was probably right. It was really, those were the two major groups that pioneered this movement. From the left, it was those who were discontent with the standardization and the homogenization of American suburban life, this reaction against mass culture. From the right, it was concern about the ungodliness of the public school system, the secularization that's coming into the humanism coming into the public schools. But both of these movements, especially, well, let me talk a little bit about the first one, a little bit more about how this caught on with the left. You go back to mid-century, America was experiencing what many have observed is a religious revival of sorts. The Protestant mainline was at an all-time high in terms of numbers, in terms of dollars, in terms of influence. But you scratched beneath the surface and you saw what was a very superficial form of religion. Martin Marty described it as a very fervent faith in a very bland religion. Dwight Eisenhower, the president of the time, was renowned for his superficial expressions of spirituality. He once said something to the effect that America depends on everyone attending and claiming a faith, and I don't care what it is, just as long as you had something. It was under the Eisenhower years that the that the National Prayer Breakfast became got started, which was a oftentimes a very superficial symbol of American civil religion, and of course this tranquility and indeed homogenization. While covered up by the prosperity of the Eisenhower years, only sowed the seeds of discontent that would yield the counterculture of the 60s. And that counterculture would give rise to all kinds of alternative spiritualities and even alternative pedagogical goals and directions. So you had the hippies, the left, pioneering educational alternatives. You also had the of course the 50s gives way to the 60s, the socially dislocating effects of the culture wars, and so what these two camps have, there's this odd underlying symmetry between the left and the right here. Both are committed to localism, to taking control over the education of their children. Both of them, for different reasons, are reacting against the what they would describe as the assembly line approach to education that that federalization has created. There were also apocalyptic images that animated their concern. For the left, there was the fear of environmental holocaust. for the right, there was the Antichrist that's embedded in the educational system of the establishment. And both of them were sort of articulating their own form of a remnant mentality, that their educational creativity had to preserve. We're surrounded by the forces of darkness, and the only alternative is to find a better way for our children. All of which should lead us to at least to begin to understand why the countercultural right and the countercultural left both began to practice and advocate homeschooling. Now, you advance that forward a quarter century, and you have a movement that's absolutely exploded. And it's emerged as a very, very popular parental option. We also have a lot of hybrids among all these forms of education. You have charter schools, you have voucher systems and the like. But one of the enduring criticisms that homeschooling has had to face is the charge. Well, what is it? What are among the criticisms that you may hear either from secular voices or even Christians expressing concerns about homeschooling? They don't get socialization skills. Right. Now, the counter argument is that that's precisely what home educators do. The only socialization that public school kids get is the socialization of the worst kind, which is peer. And homeschooling done effectively can expose a child to a broader, healthier form of socialization. But that's a charge that still sticks in a lot of quarters. You're sheltering them. You're insulating them. Okay, now these are interesting charges. These of course, we hear these all the time. And honestly, we may see some examples of, we may have evidence to support these claims. But our indefatigable sociologist, Christian Smith, did a study about 20 years ago that was published in the magazine First Things. And the article was entitled, Is Private School Privatizing? Is Private School Privatizing? And he took on the claim that parents who withdraw their children from public schools and send them to Christian schools, or more infamously, take them out of public schools and homeschool them, they are robbing their kids of the experience of being in a real community. They are abdicating their civic responsibilities, and they're contributing to the decline of the social capital that communities desperately need to sustain themselves. And he discovered that claim didn't match the evidence at all. But in fact, it was clearly the opposite of the case. Now, what you have to do to get there, he said, first of all, is to distinguish between civic and public. And it's not always those who criticize public schooling, homeschooling, often equate civic with a narrow range of activities, and public with governmental ones. And so the critics would argue that these parents are de facto against support of public institutions because they fail to support the preeminent of public institutions, public schooling. But there is a wealth of civic institutions that Christian parents, homeschooling parents, private school parents are outshining their secular counterparts in. Volunteerism in general is much, much higher among homeschooling parents and Christian school parents. There is, in fact, a widespread participation of these children as citizens in a host of important local, regional institutions. And Smith argues that the claim that private schooling privatizes is, in fact, as narrow-minded and as sectarian as that which they seek to identify in those homeschoolers. Toleration for them simply means supporting my personal institutions. And they can't countenance any other approach to civic responsible engagement short of their sacred, supporting their sacred cows. It's a landmark study which really puts to rest that charge. Private schools, homeschools, he argues, this form of education absolutely is not privatizing. Private schoolers and homeschoolers are definitely not the isolated recluses that critics suggest they may be. It is rather the public schooling families that are clearly the least civically involved of all schooling types. Well, so which is it for your church? Is it government schools? Is it public schools? Is it Christian schools? Or is it home schools? What is the educational choice you need to commend? What is the Christian alternative here? And of course, to the question I raised, the answer is obvious, right? It's homeschooling, right? We need to create churches as safe places for parents to make responsible educational decisions, free to differ with the responsible decisions that other parents are making. Too often it's the case that enthusiasm for homeschooling or for a local Christian school, to which great sacrifices were made in its creation, too often it's the case that these become the sacred institutions that you must support. You can't hope to be an officer in the church if your kid's going to public school. Or you really can't aspire to any kind of leadership if you're not making the sacrifice here. You've probably heard stories like this. I've heard it over and over and over again. The other thing I think that homeschooling has taught us is that we are all homeschoolers now, at least in this sense. Every parent is the educator of his or her child. Christian education is the duty of all parents. I think the homeschooling movement has helpfully brought this into more clarity. You may choose the public school as the best educational alternative for your child. But you are delegating, you may be delegating that duty to others, to a public teacher, to a Christian school teacher, to a tutor, whatever, but you're neither outsourcing that, nor are you abandoning your child. And I think it's important to put it in those terms that in a general sense, all parents must be homeschoolers, however they actually choose to implement that mandate that they've been given. This means staying intimately involved in the educational process, whatever that is. And I can speak as a homeschooling, as a survivor of homeschooling, as a father, how easy it is to talk the talk of homeschooling and let your wife walk the walk. I could have done a better job. I could have been more active in that. My flaws as a parent, as an educator, were revealed time and again in the educational experience of my children. We should remind, the church should remind parents that they're all educators. They're all home educators in that sense. They should also remind parents that all schooling is local. All schooling is local. Despite the dangers of bureaucracy, and I don't want to underestimate them, public schools today are still, to a remarkable extent, in the hands of local control and input. And I've heard many stories of Christians in Central Florida who have been exemplary in their way, the ways they've got engaged in their children's elementary, middle school, high school experience, and been great influences there. Gotten to know teachers, gotten established very close working relationships with their teachers. So talk of a government school. Talk about of a public school monopoly is profoundly unhelpful rhetoric that we have got to guard our tongues against. This is not helpful talk. We are obliged to know our schools, to know our children's needs, to know our children's teachers. All of this is a burden on us, however we make the decision. And you also will discover, and you may, maybe many of you have, who have had children through the educational system, you end up often making a year-by-year decision, don't you? You may discover after a year in a particular setting that your child is better suited somewhere else. So these things can't be set with any firm, we can't establish firm rules here. We have to allow parents to make what can be intensely private decisions here. Now, what about Christian schools? Christian colleges. What sort of, do the same kinds of sentiments apply to Christian colleges? It's really interesting and rather ironic, a discovery of mine that I have a lot of homeschooling friends who are really ideologically firmly committed to homeschooling. And once the kid graduates from high school, they turn radically pragmatic and indifferent about now their logic would be, well, we provide the kids the foundation. Now they can go to U of F. Now they can go to Florida State or whatever. I don't know if that's not a little bit of presumption on their part as well. I mean, why wouldn't the same logic sort of extend? Here is a place also where, now I've sent my kids to Covenant College, all four of them, and I'll be paying for this for the rest of my life. I do think it was, in every case, it was sort of an individual decision we made. And I'm persuaded it was the right one. And I am persuaded it was a, we got our bang for the buck there. But I also am very eager not to say that Christian college experience is something that we have to make at all mandatory either. I will just make this one observation. When parents are shopping for colleges with their children, and whether they're looking at a state university, a private college in another state or a Christian college. It's dismaying to me that they overlook routinely what is among the most important questions that they have to ask when they explore those colleges. And that is, where will they go to church? I almost never hear that. Well, we went and what are the churches? Oh, we didn't get around to looking at that. I mean, what you need to do, you haven't done due diligence in your search for colleges. If you haven't found a healthy church where your child is going to be able to attend and be fed regularly. There's all kinds of ways in which the faith of the youth can get shipwrecked in college. And sending them to a Christian college is no way to insulate them from that threat. The best way to protect them is to see to it that they have access to the means of grace. This need does not go on hiatus when you're in college, nor, let me add again, when you're in seminary. I do want to just say a few words about theological education. Why is this important for the ministry of the church? I would insist that every member of the church is a stakeholder in theological education. Now, this is true for everyone in this room because you're enrolled in a seminary, but it's true for a more fundamental reason than that. Every Christian is obliged to join in the investment of the training of the church's next generation. Only if you're absolutely certain that our Lord is going to return tomorrow do you have any reason to acquit yourself of this duty. We must be engaged in this question. Churches must partner in theological education. Churches have the obligation of seeing to the ministerial education and credentialing of the next generation. How to do that? How should theological education be conducted? Every crisis, if you study American Presbyterian history, and the principle I'm about to describe probably applies to Baptist history, Congregational Episcopalian history. Every crisis in the history of American Presbyterianism was at the same time a debate about theological education. Go back into colonial America. The old side, new side debate was whether or not William Tennant's Log College in Neshaminy, Pennsylvania, could offer legitimate educational credentials. Did ministers for the Presbyterian Church have to come from Edinburgh and Glasgow? Could they be trained indigenously? The old school, new school debate was largely over which Presbyterian seminary could you trust, whose graduates could you trust, Princeton's or Union's? The fundamentalist modernist controversy, ground zero of that debate was the formation of Westminster Seminary in Philadelphia, a faculty that left Princeton. The formation of Westminster preceded the formation of the OPC by 7 years. And in the 60s, the formation of RTS preceded the formation of the PCA also by 7 years. Where there is a theological controversy, there is a debate about theological education. And it's gotten to the point in this marketplace that we've created that we are awash in theological seminaries. Simply put, there are too many of them. Each one has the challenge of creating, of establishing, and cultivating a sustainable market share. And each one of them has the challenge of promoting itself as the place where you need to go to be educated. And it's hard to promote yourself positively without describing your competition negatively. This marketplace has created a dizzying world of choices. All of you had to negotiate those choices before you made the right choice to come here, right? I confess that I don't have the answer to the problem of theological education. I confess that RTS is, in many respects, part of the problem. This multi-campus institution that we founded has been part of this marketplace we've created, this intense competition. For good reason, folks made decisions to establish Westminster as an independent seminary and RTS as an independent seminary. Should seminaries be independent, or should they be arms of the church? There are strong arguments to support either one of those positions. It is through the historical circumstances into which those two institutions got formed, it was wise, I'm convinced, for them to take the direction of independence that they took. In neither case were they shackled by the tyranny of liberalism. But don't think that the marketplace is a more gentle master than liberalism. We struggle as a school. Theological education in America struggles as a whole because of the demands of the marketplace. And the real crisis in theological education to me, the real scandal of theological education today, is the sticker price. Now, thank you for paying it, because you're paying my salary. But I don't know how you do it. I don't know how I would have done it. And I think it really is terribly irresponsible for schools, RTS included, to send graduates into churches with huge educational debt. The only way out of this is, at least one important way out of this is for churches to own up to their role as partnering in the task of theological education. But we've got to create a better system, because all of you are the victims of this kind of stuff. And I just want to say, I'm genuinely sorry for this. This is an unhealthy state of affairs. Now, Mark, you were joking about all your scholarships. And good for you if you have them. And good for all of you if you have them. That's wonderful. That's a dent into the problem. Yeah, I'm sure it doesn't. And it is, you're making tremendous sacrifices. And for that, you have my respect. You have my sympathy, not my envy. And this is really, really a horrible burden. We've got to find a better way than this. You know, Marx was right. It's all about money. But I wouldn't necessarily see that as a problem of recent vintage. I mean, I think that there's always been a debate, certainly in American Protestantism, about what constitutes adequate education and credentialing. And one of the reasons why Presbyterians as the Western frontier expanded and settlements developed and churches followed, the reason why Presbyterians were at a competitive disadvantage is because that Presbyterians and Episcopalians and others clung to this notion of an educated clergy, that you needed certain educational qualifications. And the Disciples of Christ, Methodists, Baptists, these other groups were able to populate the frontier much more quickly because they weren't burdened with those greater standards. Now, Presbyterians are, and this is a matter of constant debate. Debate about theological education is as old as theological education. What do we really need to put in the curriculum? What do ministers need to know? What don't they need to know? There's constant tinkering. There's no simple solution to that question. It's something that rightly changes as culture presents differing challenges before the church. It's going to be an enduring problem for us. But the answer is not to short-circuit the process. Questions, thoughts, comments, angry? And you want a moment with the therapist here? Well, thank you for your patience. Thank you for your tuition dollars.
The preceding program has been brought to you by RTS on iTunes U and may not be reproduced or disseminated in part or in whole for sale or for profit without express written consent. For more information on RTS degrees and programs, please visit us at www.rts.edu or call 1-855-854-6920.